Welcome back to Wyoming Through New Eyes. My name is Carolyn. If you haven't joined us before, I'm a student at UW along with my best friend, Taylor. I'm studying communications and I know nothing about Wyoming, but actually I know more than I did last episode.
And I am the aforementioned best friend, Taylor. I grew up in Wyoming and I study wildlife and fisheries biology here.
If you were with us last time, we discussed our first road trip to Wyoming, which was to Lander and Thermopolis. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome. We're so happy to have you. Feel free and visit our website to check out our previous episodes, the introduction episode, as well as our first road trip. If you want to look at all the pictures of us being absolutely knuckleheads on our road trips.
Accurate.
Yeah. If you want to look at all of the sources that we have laid out as well, we like to tie in some academic parts to this because, after all, we are students and this is our capstone project, so we must have academic sources. But our website is going to be tkandcwuwcapstone.wordpress.com.
Today we're going to talk about our next road trip that we went on, which was to Rock Springs, Wyoming, and some of the stuff surrounding that. This trip was actually only a day long, and we stopped by a few different places. We wanted to go on this trip before the weather turned last fall, and it was about to get bad for the week, so it was a bit of a spur-of-the-moment trip, which, as it turns out, was kind of some of the best planning for memories.
Yeah.
So we had a pretty good time.
Spur of the moment means I get a text from Taylor at 9 a.m. going, hey, do you want to drive to Rock Springs? And I went, sure. She goes, great, let's take your car. I'm like, okay, fine, let's take my car.
Took your car for a reason. Yeah. We'll get to it later.
Yeah, whatever.
To kick off our deep dive of all of the places we went to near Rock Springs, let's start off with Carol Ann's queries. What questions are you thinking of today, my dear?
Why, thank you. So I've only ever driven by Rock Springs. I think it was on to another place. I think we drove past it when we were driving to Lander.
We were in a similar place for some of the places.
Yeah.
For some of the time.
I remember driving past it. There was a bunch of trucks. Anyway, my first big question is, Rock Springs a popular city? Like, what exactly is it known for? What's the deal?
All right. So Rock Springs is one of the bigger cities in Wyoming. It's right along our main interstate, and it's one of those ones that has a bigger school. I think Rock Springs is a 4A school in most of their sports, and that is a very Wyoming way to measure town size, is by how big the school is, what classification they are. For contrast, I grew up in Hewlett, which has a 1A school, and that means they're in, like, smaller divisions of stuff, and those are classed sizes so that, like, the giant schools and the little schools can kind of compete with on equal playing fields, essentially. Rock Springs itself is a really old town, which is really clear to me whenever I drive there, because you can tell that they paved a lot of the roads, like, between encampments and between, like, horse trails, because none of the roads are very straight. And then they expanded it and, you know, more bigger than it was originally planned. But originally, Rock Springs was all about the railroad that runs right through it. It's still there. And some of the Old West outlaws that used to hang out there. Butch Cassidy was known to hang out in Wyoming.
No way.
I know.
That's so cool. I didn't know that. That's one of the few cowboy names I know. Wow.
Today, more than anything, Rock Springs and the area around it is known for the interstate going right through it and the extraction industry.
Huh. Also, it's really funny that your school is 1A. I'm very proud of, I loved Hewlett, and I love your family, and I loved walking through it, but my school was 4A, so it's really, really funny for me to hear that. Anyway, the other thing, when we were in Rock Springs, we'll get to this later in the episode as well, but we stopped by a place with horses. I forget its name, and I have no idea what it's called.
Talk about it later.
Yes, but my question was, what's the deal with the horses?
Yeah, so wild horses and burros are governed by the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act from 1971, which essentially puts the Bureau of Land Management in charge of sort of managing the population of wild horses in the area. The place we went was one of the places where they have wild horse pens. They store horses there that they've gathered when there's too many of them. The idea is then that they're, like, not overrunning the landscape because horses can kind of expand their population size really, really fast. Lots of people really love getting to see wild horses on their drive, and you do get to see them a lot in the Red Desert. And lots of people also have really big thoughts on whether we should have wild horses and how they should be managed. It's actually a really, really big controversy, beginning kind of fundamentally with the part where these wild horses are feral rather than truly wild, because horses, this lineage of horses scientifically, are not native to the Americas. The horses that we have that are wild came over with explorers and such. However, I'm not really here to start that conversation, though I do have my own opinions on it, so we can move on to the next query.
Ooh, grab a shovel, everyone. We're digging in. No. Okay, this is my stupid question of the day. I'm full of stupid questions. I'm not.
No, you're not.
Okay, let me rephrase. It's not that I'm a stupid person. It's that they're dumbly phrased. Like I said, I'm from Colorado Springs. If you put me in Denver and you ask me to drive around the city, I will do just fine. I'm not scared of traffic. I frequently use my horn, even though it is kind of scary. But the concept of driving on a dirt road scares the crap out of me. So, how does one learn to drive off-road?
So to all you listeners, don't worry. We're going to get the whole Carol Ann driving bit in a while. But we had a really good time with it. For context, I learned how to drive in alfalfa fields and on dirt roads. So driving off-road is more normal to me than, say, driving in downtown Denver and using my horn. And no one uses their blinkers in downtown Denver for whatever reason. What we actually did on this trip wasn't technically off-road. It's just a really rough road. A really rough road where we were, and I definitely wouldn't try to bring my little Buick through it, which is why we took your car. But if you've got a bit of a higher undercarriage, you'll usually be okay out on these roads. A lot of the roads that we were on, their condition has to do with how much water there is and how it goes through the desert, but you can always handle it if you can kind of anticipate how the terrain is going to affect the vehicle's movement. And there's sort of a dirt road etiquette that you learn when you're growing up in the boonies, for lack of a better term. If nothing else, it really came in handy for me on this trip and when I worked in a remote and rural environment in the summer.
Yeah, the etiquette that I learned is very different than the etiquette that you learned. Like, the whole blinker thing, I get that, why people don't do it. I still use my blinker, so please don't come for me. But anyway, like I said, I've only ever driven through Rock Springs, so I have very little experience it. But the drive out itself was really fun. I started the drive on a nice big road. It was paved. It was lovely. But getting stopped in the middle of nowhere by the man-made traffic light. Okay, for context, I'd never seen this before, but we came across a bridge, and one of the sides of the bridges was closed, and so they put up this little dinky traffic light off of I-80, like an interstate, and they've made us come to a full stop when no one was on the other side of the bridge, so that was, I was entertained by it. There's a selfie on my phone that proves it, but I did not post that, because Taylor's face was not amused.
That does happen a lot with construction, especially in these bigger rural areas. There's an ongoing, very Midwestern joke that goes something like, there's only two real seasons, Wyoming, and they both have to do with having to drive. The two seasons in Wyoming are ice and construction. So we have a really limited window of construction-worthy weather, so we really take advantage of it. I've spent a decent amount of time in Rock Springs with the Wyoming All-State Marching Band that I did in high school, and with sports, and with student council, but a lot of that was a while ago, given that I'm a senior in college now. What really draws me and lots of other people to the area is the recreation opportunities outside Rock Springs. There's really something for everybody, even if you wouldn't expect it.
Yeah, by the way, the McDonald's in Rock Springs has pretty darn good muffins. I'm not sponsored or anything, but recreation doesn't come close to a good muffin.
You're just a fan of pastries.
Yeah, that's true. I have a problem, guys. My budget has a specific part that's meant just for pastries and baked goods. The first place that we went was the White Mountain Petroglyphs, which we switched and Taylor was driving because I was a little more uncomfortable driving because there had just been some precipitation and I didn't know where we were going, and having a vague idea is better than having no idea at all. So I directed, Taylor drove.
I cackle a little bit when we tell this story. Like, I'll reiterate, Carol Ann raised in the suburbs, me, rural Wyoming, washed out dirt road, all manner of mud and ice. I take all of that over traffic. So we typically take turns driving our vehicles for road trips, and then we try to split expenses with, like, gas and then split drive time so no one feels like they're doing too much. Because it gets tiring, you know. But we get out on this really washboarded dirt road on the way, and Carol Ann's a little nervous, so we just change spots. But it was pretty easy to find. It's a pretty flat area. You're going to end up at the petroglyphs. The GPS will get you there. I will note, I hadn't been there in quite a while, so I hadn't been to the petroglyphs or to the Red Desert area, except for just passing through since the summer before my senior year of high school. So I had that vague idea of where we were going, like Carol Ann said, even though I think Carol Ann thought I was just making it up.
You were! Okay, here's what the map looked like. I have a point about this. I'm sitting in shotgun holding Taylor's Google Maps, and it's literally just green. Like, it's a line through it. There's nothing around it. It's just the one road. And the nice Google lady was like, turn left in 5 miles. And you look above, and there's only one turn. It's either you go left or you go straight. And for some reason, we made a wrong turn. I don't know how that happened. I
think we got there.
We got there.
That's all that matters.
It was not that big a deal, but I guess we were trying to, like, find a shortcut and cut the corner, whatever it was. Maybe it was instruments. Maybe it was weather. But we did get there, made the left turns. There was a sign that said White Mountain Petroglyphs.
And that happens a lot, honestly, with Google Maps and, like, pretty rural places, because there's a lot of little roads that can get you to the same place. We probably should have used, like, a BLM map that has all of the really specific places.
Yeah, looking back on it, probably.
I was very sure that we were not going to get stuck on the road, and that's all that really matters.
I mean, yeah, that would have sucked. Getting stuck would have been the worst, but
it was a little muddy, but not bad, and there were some decent ruts, but I also think we weren't on a super traditional route. As Caroline said, we took a detour. And I'll also note that much of what we experienced in this trip was on and around the Red Desert, which is a pretty expansive desert, but maybe not what you're thinking about when it comes to the word desert. We'll talk about the sand dunes we saw later, and that might be what you expect when you hear desert, but there's also a ton of sagebrush out there, and it's still a desert because of the climate. Deserts are a biome, and so they are designated by how much precipitation or moisture they get and by the temperature extremes. So we actually have cold deserts in the world, which is kind of cool. And a lot of the Red Desert and the area is sagebrush steppe, which isn't a lot of people's favorite part of Wyoming because they just look out at this expanse of sagebrush. But it's really cool. I still love it, and here's why. Sagebrush is one of the coolest habitats to some of the coolest species in Wyoming. So we have an elk herd out here. There are a lot of little critters that like rabbits that love sagebrush. And my personal favorite is the sage grouse, which is an awesome little bird. We didn't get to see any on this trip, but I very much recommend seeing the documentary Sagebrush Sea about this area, and I've probably seen it 3 or 4 times.
If I had a dime for every time Taylor said sage grouse on our trip, gas expenses would be paid for.
Cool birds, guys.
It's not saying they're not cool birds. I'm just acknowledging that I'm well aware of now what a sage grouse is. But after driving out, we ended up at our first feature, the White Mountain Petroglyphs. The BLM sign, it looked really fun, and we were the only ones out there. So you pull up, and you park, and then you walk.
Yeah. As you guys might have picked up on if you've tuned into the last couple episodes, I think petroglyphs are just some of the most amazing features in Wyoming. I first visited the site the summer before my senior year of high school on a school trip, so almost 5 years ago. That's terrifying.
We're old. Oh my gosh.
And I do think it really is one of those little hidden gems in Wyoming that we're like making this podcast for that not a lot of folks know about. When I went the first time, I was on this school trip and we had someone from the nearby Bureau of Land Management office sort of guide us around and explain things to us, point out pieces, kind of the works. It was really nice.
Yeah, basically there's like a nice little shed that you walk past and then there's like a 100-yard trail and then you turn right and there's a giant rock and there's a bunch of petroglyphs on it. It was kind of just like poof. Like I don't know better to explain it than just instant petroglyph.
There's like this hillside of sandstone just all of a sudden.
Yeah, like you don't see it when you're driving up and then it's just right there. But it was really cool because there weren't any velvet ropes or anything. It was just like us being there, not touching the rocks, because that's not cool. Preserve history.
Yeah. And these petroglyphs definitely look a little different than the ones we talked about last week. First of all, the cliff face that we're talking about, this like hillside, it's all sandstone, which is a really soft stone. And that means some of the art has really just been lost to time or to vandalism or is harder to see. And the vandalism is really, really sad. And I have lots of thoughts about that too, but we don't have time for it. And the art itself on these petroglyphs is a lot younger than some of other places that you can see in the U.S. The oldest estimation of this site that I could find was like maximum 1,000 years old, which if we're being real is still really impressive and kind of insane. And that makes it even more important to emphasize that you really need to keep your distance and be respectful. Not only are these like powerful places and ones that have a lot of meaning, but touching anything here is even more destructive than it would be in some other places because the sandstone is so fragile.
Yeah, for sure. The cool part about the rock was not just the petroglyphs, but there was a bunch of little holes that like animals had burrowed into. So It kind of, this is creepy, but it kind of looked like a rock out of a horror movie because all of the holes right there. And I'm against the vandalism of this, but it was interesting because, like, one of the things I remember was there was a signature of someone from 1919. I'm like, okay, that's 100-year-old vandalism. There's some history with that. Some vagrant somewhere is like, yeah, I want to carve my name in a rock.
It's a little bit like going to, like, registers, Cliff, and stuff like that, where, like, the Mormon Trail came through, or the Oregon Trail. Excuse me if I'm wrong on those. But,
yeah, no, but the actual petroglyphs themselves were so much cooler than just initials. They had, like, different animals and birds and people with cool head things and head dresses, and it was just cool. It was just cool.
Oh, yeah. So one side of the rock is all kind of, like, hunting and game animals, you know, elk, stuff like that, and then you sort of round the corner, and there's this rock sticking out a little bit separate. And that's what they call the birthing rock. Seeing the birthing rock for me is just, like, really powerful. It's kind of like walking into a church. And it's thought that this is a site where women from the Great Basin Native American tribes gave birth. And because of the repeated use and the softness of the sandstone, there are, like, actual handprints that have become handholds in the rock. And it's one of those places, it's just really contemplative. You sit there in silence and you think about it. And if you've been following along to this point, silence is really unusual for Carolyn and me, so that means something here.
Yeah, that was really powerful.
It's so cool.
It is really cool. Surrounding the rock, though, is a bunch of sage grass, and I do have a picture of Taylor just, like, looking at sage grass.
You mean grass?
Is it? Oh, whoops, my bad.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's grass.
Different kinds of shrubberies.
Taylor has an app that checks out plants, so we did a lot of, like, discovery of plants as well as rocks.
Shout out to the Seek app. I use it all the time in my job, and it tells me what plants are, and I love plants, and she takes pictures of me checking out plants because she thinks it's funny.
I respect your passion. I love it for you, but when I look at a plant, I just see a plant, and I'm so proud that you actually see differences in plants. That's so cool. Anyway, so we kind of spent a little bit of time here. We took some pictures. We just kind of contemplated life. Not sponsored at all in this podcast, but Sprite Cranberry had just come out. So Taylor was drinking her Sprite Cranberry during
this. Making fun of me the whole time.
This is what I do.
And from there, we drove to the Boar's Tusk, yes, which is a really cool rock formation nearby.
That's what I was tuning into, but it's this really cool thing. We got back in the car, and we got back on the main dirt road, and you kind of pull up to it, and it's just this big, for lack of a better term, sticky rock-looking thing. Educational. I'm a college student. But it really is just sticking out of the ground, and it kind of looks like a scary scene from Lion King.
It's one of the really, like, non-flat things in this area. It's one of the only things, so you can see it for miles, but getting up there was actually interesting with all of those, like, crisscrossing roads. The rock structure itself is like 400 feet tall, so it's a really popular climbing spot. And geologically, the history there is that the rock formation is the remnant of an ancient volcano, a little bit like Devil's Tower, which we'll talk about next week.
Shameless plug, episode 3. Woohoo!
And so the type of rock that forms this formation is different from other places surrounding the area. It's lamproite, which I guess isn't a terribly common rock, as I learned in my research. And this particular kind of lamproite is also called Wyomingite, according to an article in Wyoming's Rocket Miner newspaper by a lady named Ann Jance. And I thought that was really awesome.
I feel really bad now whenever I talk to native Wyoming people. I call them Wyomingites, and that's a type of rock. So I should probably...
We call ourselves Wyomingites.
Oh, good. It's not just me. Okay. But from the Boar's Tusk, Taylor mentioned the winding roads. If we had kept going, we would have seen the lovely sand dunes. It was really weird, because it was just like this patch of sand, like, you're not expecting it, and the moral of the story is this trip was just like random cool natural landmarks that appear out of nowhere.
And I think it's so wild that you can see them. We didn't get exactly right up next to them because it's quite a drive out there, but you can see them, and they're just like this bright white, like, wave in the middle of nowhere, and it's kind of like a movie like sand dune setup. One time I was there, I knew a couple of kids that couldn't resist rolling down the sand dunes. Oh, like, you would roll down a hill of grass. And then they spent like 3 days just absolutely miserable because we were camping and they couldn't wash the sand off.
Oh no, that's awful.
But the sand dunes we're talking about are called the Killpecker Sand Dunes, and there are a few different recreation areas out there for people to go and join them if you're into, like, dune buggies. That's kind of what I'm thinking.
Nice. I visited the Colorado sand dunes at one point, and it's the same concept of like beautiful mountains and then sand dunes in the middle of nowhere. But we took a bunch of sleds out there and we hiked up to the top of the sand dunes and we sled down. And I feel so bad for those kids because I was covered in sand. Like, I found sand in my scalp, like, after I showered. There was so much sand. But it was really fun. But it was really cool to drive past because they were just there. But after we got back, we were finished with Forest Tusk and sand dunes, we drove back on our lovely dirt road to a main paved road. And we drove to the horse pace. I don't know what it is. What is it?
It's the Rock Springs Wild Horse Holding Facility. And guys, before we really dive into the topic of these wild horses, I will add that wild horses and their presence in Wyoming and elsewhere can be really controversial. It's a really nuanced topic. And we just want to put it out there that while our experiences for the purpose of this podcast are being shared in a positive light, we don't want to belittle others' opinions, and our opinions belong to us alone and do not reflect any other body, including UW and the Honors College. I will also mention, in case any of you are worried, that the BLM is very careful to treat these animals as humanely as possible, whether they are wild on the range, being gathered, on one of their long-term pastures that they're sent to after being held. It's a very regulated process, I promise.
Horses were actually really pretty and cool to look at, but we just wanted to put that out there just because we know this can be a little bit of a touchy topic, and we are broke college students. We cannot afford any sort of lawsuit. You will only receive my microwave.
You can have my student loans.
Yeah, you can take that from me. Thank you.
Yes, but in all seriousness, like, this is very nuanced. I'm not sharing the whole of my opinion. We don't have the time to get into the nitty-gritty of this, and there are no completely correct answers. So just please be aware of that as we go into this topic. So like we talked about a little bit earlier, the Bureau of Land Management does most of the management that we're familiar with concerning these animals. And one of the main things they're supposed to do here with the horses is make sure that this feral population doesn't go over carrying capacity. And carrying capacity just means that there aren't more out there than the land and the environment can support. So they're not just out there wrecking everything. And every species in the wild has a carrying capacity, and they cycle. Like, one of the classic ones is like hare and lynx cycling. So that's not unique to manage around carrying capacity. So what they end up doing is they oversee land use as well as the horses and public land. So these wild horses have to share space with livestock and wildlife like elk. And so we just need to manage them like we would manage other things. But like I said, horses expand really quickly, so they sometimes require a little more intervention than some other things might. And the reason we have a bunch corralled down here is because of that population control. And then you can actually adopt a wild horse or burro. That's one of those big things when they take them in off the range. They try to find them homes.
That's so cute. I want a horse. That'd be so fun. Hey, Mom, I've graduated college. Can I have a horse?
Buy yourself a Mustang. Has no training.
See, when most people think buy yourself a Mustang, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to buy myself a muscle car because I graduated college. No, I'm from Wyoming now. I'm going to get myself a horse. It was actually really cool, though. I usually don't get to see horses. The last time I ever rode a horse was on my distant uncle's ranch. He had some horses, and he was like, Caroline, get on. Like, okay, cool. So we put on helmets and we rode around. But the horses here, it was very interesting to see them. They had actually a viewing area. So we parked the car and they had a little gazebo with the cool, like, signs that were talking about every, like, what all the horses are from and the different breeds and all of the stuff that Taylor was talking about. But it was cool. Yeah.
But that was kind of the end of our little trip.
I mean, in retrospect, the trip was really fun. It was just a day trip, so it's not as long as our Lander Thermopolis episode, because that did take 2 days. 3 days. Whatever amount of
something
days.
Something like that.
It was a weekend. We spent a lot of time together. That's the moral of the story. But we got back on the road shortly after that. We alternated drivings. We stopped and just kind of listen to music. I think I fell asleep at one point, which was kind of nice.
You took a good old nap. I remember that.
Car naps are the best. If I had a rant moment, it would be about car naps. Anyway, with this episode coming to a close, it is now time for the Curiosity Corner. If you're with us for the first time, this is basically where I set a timer for 3 minutes and Taylor just gets to go off. There are lots of things that she can talk about. So with that, Taylor, are you ready?
I am ready and I'm very excited.
Okay. What are you going to talk about real fast?
We're going to talk about Wyoming's only endangered plant.
Cool. Let's do it. Ready, set, go.
Yeah. So today, my Curiosity Corner is also where our academic / research highlight is going to fit in. So listeners, you're getting a twofer today. Our trip to Rock Springs takes us right by and through that red desert region we've been talking about and through Carbon County, which is home to Wyoming's one and only endangered plant. Bet you didn't know plants could be endangered. Penstemon haydeni, I might be saying that wrong, or blowout penstemon or blowout beard tongue, all the same thing. Super cool because it grows on the edges of sand dunes. And like we've already talked about, sand dunes are these kind of wild things in the middle of nowhere, and they move. They can move like 3 meters a year. And this wild little rebellious flower grows on the edge of them, which is super cool. It's a really pretty little purple flower, and it's also what is called a Lazarus species. And Lazarus species are super cool because we call something a Lazarus species when we've declared it extinct and then we find it somewhere else. So for like 20 years back in the 1900s, we thought this species was just gone, like completely gone. And then we found it again. We found it in Nebraska and in the sand dunes in Wyoming. So there are a few different populations here of it. Research from some folks named Heidel, Cox, and Blomquist, published in the Western North American Naturalist, suggests that from the physical structure of our sand dunes here in Wyoming and the fact that they move the way they do, they think that blowout penstemon, this flower, was actually here the whole time that we considered this species extinct. And we just didn't know, which is wild. It also really proved in this paper how critical the Wyoming habitat for this blowout penstemon is. And sand dune management requires a lot of care. So now we know that the area buffers that we've set up by the BLM to, you know, give this plant space to kind of recover are just as important, if not more important, than we already thought. I spent a lot of time IDing plants in my life. I spend a lot of time with a lot of penstemons. As we talked about, I have the Seek app. My favorite thing is to try to find out which shrubs I can eat. But I promise, do not listen to me when I tell you you can eat anything, because you should always know, like 100% sure, be confident you're not going to die before you eat something, and you should never listen to your buddy who knows what they're doing. That is official plant ecology advice. Never eat something unless you're 100% sure you're not going to die or you trust the person next to you with your life. I like to eat raspberries and huckleberries in the wild. I'm pretty sure about those ones. But seeing a blowout penstemon would be just as great as finding a wild huckleberry patch. It's so cool.
I have so much to say about that. First off, okay, the fact that sand dunes move.
They move. Like, what? 3 meters a year. They can move.
That's a lot of space to move. Like I knew glaciers moved. I got that. But that makes sense because they're ice. And if you drop an ice cube on the floor, it moves. Like, just they're giant ice. But sand dunes. Oh, that's
They're like
cool.
This living thing almost, which is just wild.
Earth is cool. We need a documentary about sand dunes. I would love to watch Will Smith go on sand dunes.
Smith and David Attenborough, get on it.
Yes, maybe throw some Benedict Cumberbatch in there. That would be amazing. Also, beard tongue?
That is like a group of flowers. A lot of things are called beard tongues, and that gets me into a whole other rant about taxonomy and how we call things. For example, starfish are neither stars nor fishes, so there's like a whole problem with that. But we have all of this like description-based taxonomy that makes no sense. Taxonomy is like how you name stuff, right? And beard tongues is one of those ones where you kind of look at it twice and you're like, okay, and then you just get used to it.
I'm kind of uncomfy looking at the word. Like, I'm sorry, but
they're really beautiful plants.
I'm sure they are. Purple flowers sound lovely, and the fact that they come back from the dead makes them even better. Like,
they don't come back from the dead.
You said they were Lazarus plants.
Okay, I understand where you're going. They were alive the whole time. We just didn't know.
Right. Like, the species that was extinct, and then they came back to life. Lazarus. They were dead. They came back.
But isn't that cool? I love that term.
They've got some pretty darn cool, fun things to say. Like, and Lazarus species. That's a cool one. Like, kudos to the scientists who came up with that. But beard tongue. Are we serious? Sorry, that's just my thing. It's just like I have beard tongue.
You should see how we spell things sometimes.
Nah, I'm good. Your guys' spelling bee sounds like one out of a horror movie. It just sounds awful.
Scientific name spelling bee. Now there's a big ticket idea. Let's get on it at our conferences.
Yes. Let's add it to all of the conversations and the talks and stuff like that. A spelling bee. That'd be amazing. But that was really cool. I didn't realize that like there was so much that came with the sand dunes. I thought they would just be sand, but there's more to it. That's awesome. As usual, all the information we talked about today, including any of the sources that we talked about, the previous episodes we've done for the Land of Demopolis one or for our introduction episode, they are all available on our website, which is tkandcwuwcapstone.wordpress.com. And feel free to check out our pictures, a little bit more about me and Taylor. We have small biographies on there. Thank you very much to the Honors College for being so amazing and supporting us in all this. To Peter Perelin, to Jocelyn Cassidy, Maggie Borquet, our advisor. She's been wonderful in helping us figure out actually how to be successful in this. Thank you to Code Library for tolerating us as we giggle incessantly for an hour in their podcast booth. I wonder what they think about us.
Okay. They recognize us. They know us.
Yeah, they do. They recognized me on the phone, which was a shocker. But we're sitting in a little podcast booth. We'll post a picture sometime in the future, I promise. But we're sitting in a little booth, and there's a wooden door. And we had a friend last time we were recording, and she's like, I heard you guys giggling. What were you laughing about?
Everything.
Everything. All the time. It's just laughter.
With that, thank you guys so much for tuning in and for listening to all of our adventures. And we're signing off for this time, but until next time, this is Wyoming Through New Eyes.